Well, thanks very much. So I guess my purpose in this talk is a little bit ambiguous, but I think Roshi's suggestion, I'm going to give a very general talk about, in some sense, stuff that's ancient history, but I think might be instructive for everybody to see how at least some part of the mathematical community has been thinking about these types of asymptotic boundary problems and these sort of interior to boundary correspondences. And so, again, I'll be covering various things. So what I want to present is a number of different results and try to give some sort of feeling for some of the methods that have been used for doing so. So I think it's everybody's responsibility if I'm going too slowly or too fast. Give me a thumbs up, thumbs down, throw me to the lions. Okay, so our setup is, as you all know, so we have a compact manifold with boundary. Boundary. It's all right. The boundary of M is equal to Y. And we'll be looking at a special class of metrics on these. So the first definition is that a metric G is called conformally compact. If it has the following expression, G looks like rho to the minus 2 times G bar, where here G bar is a smooth or at least non-degenerate metric, so I'll just say smooth, I'm not going to be too interested in boundary regularity issues, smooth metric on, let me say, specifically the closure of the manifold, namely it's a metric all the way up to the boundary, and rho is a defining function for the boundary. Which means just that rho is equal to 0 on y, rho is positive on m minus y, and d rho is non-zero at y. So this decomposition is very non-unique, and factorization of G is very non-unique, as I'll come to in just a moment. But the important point here is, also know, is that G is obviously not well-defined at the boundary. It's only a Riemannian metric in the interior. And this power here is exactly the right one to make it complete. So here's manifold, it may have some topology in the interior, and rho is going to 0 here, and what the effect of this conformal factor is doing is blowing it out to infinity. So standard example is hyperbolic space, and these are, of course, just modeled on the Poincaré-Ball model of hyperbolic space. So this is the basic example. Hn plus 1. So this is the ball, and g is equal to 4 over 1 minus mod x squared times the g bar. G bar is the Euclidean metric. Okay, so some very elementary computations. So first of all, if I compute the curvature tensor of this, so as I already stated, these are complete in the interior. They're not defined a priori at the boundary. The curvature tensor, Rijkl, near the boundary, has the following form. It looks like minus d rho g bar squared times familiar combination g I k g j l minus g I l g j k plus an error term, which is big O of rho to the minus 3. The point being here that these g's, well, if I have a quadratic expression in these, then it's of order rho to the minus 4 near the boundary, so this is a lower order term. Now, this term here should be suspect if at first glance, simply because, well, I can also write g is equal to a rho to the minus 2 times a squared g bar. Namely, this is the basic conformal. These are g's and not g bars. So the effect of this, of course, is that the sectional curvatures, what I do is r I j I j divided by the familiar thing is going to be this. So if you like, Kij, the sectional curvature in the direction ij at the boundary, let's say as rho goes to 0, is equal to minus d rho g bar squared. Okay. So another way to say this is that the sectional the curvature tensor is, whatever complicated thing it is in the interior, but as you go towards the boundary, it becomes isotropic. Okay. Now, this expression is involving two non-invariant things, not well-defined things. It's supposed to be intrinsic to g. So I could replace rho by a rho and g bar by a squared g bar. And well, if I do this, d, so if this is, let's call this rho hat, and this is g hat, then d rho hat is going to be a d rho plus rho dA. And if I compute the g hat norm of this thing, well, it's going to be different, but at rho equals 0, they're the same. Okay, so this is a well-defined quantity. Okay, so going along with that is the point that g bar is not well-defined, but what is well-defined is, sort of why we're all here this week, is this mapping. So if I take g and I associate to it the following. I take g bar, by which I mean I take g and I multiply it by the square of any defining function. I restrict that to the tangent bundle of y, and I take the conformal class. So this is the well-defined mapping. So this is C of g, and this is called a conformal infinity mapping. Okay, so this is the basic object that we're interested in. Okay, so far I'm just working in this general category of conformally compact spaces. And, well, there were a number of geometric reasons to study these. I mean, these were introduced, 20, 25 years ago, in some sense in this form. And the motivations, certainly I was one of the people involved, Robin Graham also, and they also came up in Penrose's program in physics and other places. And in some sense, it's exactly this reason that you have a conformal structure at infinity and some sort of Riemannian structure in the interior. And the hope was to find some sort of correspondences between these. And of course, if you just fill it in with an arbitrary conformally compact metric, you know, there's not much uniqueness. There's, you know, it's not a very canonical way of filling. So the idea by Guffman and Graham. Was to fixate, so you start with a given manifold, M, and you start with a conformal class, which I'll call, let me just write it as C, and this is a conformal class on Y, so this is a conformal class on the boundary. I'd like to find one of these conformally compact metrics, so I want a conformally compact metric G. It has two properties. One is that its conformal infinity is exactly this given conformal class. And the second is that it's Einstein. So reach G, and then the normalization, the natural normalization here is M times G is equal to 0. Okay, so manifolds of this type I'll call Poincaré-Einstein. There are a number of other names, but this seems like a fairly good one. So if these two properties are the case, G Poincaré-Einstein. Okay, so these are our basic objects of interest. So what I want to do today is sketch for you a number of results that have been proved within the mathematical literature, as I say, over the past 20 years or so. And there are a number of different types of things, sort of algebraic, geometric, and analytic properties. And as I also said, try to give you some sort of idea for the analytic methods that have been used to study these. Some examples. Hyperbolic space I just erased. And what other? So the first examples are the constant curvature examples. So anytime I have Hn plus 1 quotiented out by a group where gamma is what's called a convex co-compact group. Okay, so what this means is that the quotient will be non-compact in infinite volume, and gamma is supposed to have no parabolic elements, so there are no cusps. So geometrically, you expect these things to sort of have these huge exponentially growing m's. The precise definition of convex co-compact is that I look at the limit set of gamma. Well, I don't know if I need to say that. But it's infinite. The volume is infinite. So these are exponentially growing n. So you don't have the standard cusp ends that you're sort of used to with. Convex co-compact. So what it means is that the convex core is compact. Okay, so the convex core of a hyperbolic manifold is sort of the largest convex set sitting inside of it. So typically, you know, if you have a geodesic which escapes this convex core, it's gone. It goes out to infinity. But there's some sort of complicated convex set here. Its boundary is not very smooth, typically. It's a laminated flat surface. And it's convex. It's the largest one. And if that's compact, that's then the manifold convex compact. Okay, so this is a very good and rich class of examples. There are lots and lots of these. Okay. Other examples, well, there may well be several disjoint boundaries. Let me give you one example of a construction of these. So there's a lot of different ways to get these things. Let me give you two important classes of examples of these things. One is, suppose that, let's suppose that Z is equal to one dimension down. So Hn modulo gamma is compact. Okay. Then I include this into one higher dimensional space. So there's a construction. M is going to be topologically R cross Z. And the metric is dt squared plus hyperbolic cos squared t times the metric on Z. Okay. Now, what this is doing is something like this. So here's your copy of Z. It's a compact hyperbolic manifold. And then you have two ends. So when n is 2, this is known as a Kleinian group, a Fuchsian. These are the Fuchsian groups sitting inside SL2C. Okay. That's one example. The other example are these famous examples of Schottky groups. So it's easiest to draw these in H3. What I do is I take an even number of disjoint hemispheres. Say there are four of them here. So I take this set of disjoint hemispheres, and I'm going to define for you the group gamma. What I do is I just choose a pairing between these hemispheres. So let's say I want to pair this one to this one, and this one to this one. So here's a group gamma 1. Here's a hyperbolic motion gamma 1. Namely, what I'm doing is I'm taking the hyperbolic element, namely the hyperbolic translation, which pushes this hemisphere onto this one. And I'm taking the hyperbolic element, which pushes this one onto this one. And I let gamma be the group generated by gamma 1 and gamma 2. And it's in fact a nice geometric exercise to check that this acts discretely, properly, discontinuously. So the fact that I get a nice convex co-compact quotient is a fairly easy geometric argument. And the topology of the corresponding surface is it's a solid handle body of genus, I forget, something related to the number of hemispheres. Okay, so those are some good examples. So these are the constant curvature ones. Well, yes, but not hyperbolic. They're, in fact, these things. In fact, I'll get to those later on. They're Einstein, but they're not hyperbolic. So the quasi-Fuchsian guys are when n equals 2 here, so I have a hyperbolic three-manifold, and there's this very beautiful theory that's due to Lippmann-Behrs, which says the following. There's a complete classification of the hyperbolic, of the so-called geometrically finite hyperbolic manifolds with this kind of topology. And, well, what I have up here is some Riemann surface. What I have down here is some Riemann surface. As I've told you, these already have conformal structures. And the remarkable thing is I can vary the conformal structures completely independently of one another. So it's the product of Teichmuller spaces, which parameterizes the hyperbolic structures on this cylinder. Okay? It's a very beautiful theorem. And so you'd like to know if there's some analog of that in higher dimensions. And the answer is, you know, yes, but you can't stay working within hyperbolic manifolds. And, well, in higher dimensions, these are hyperbolic 3, 4, 5 manifolds, and they don't deform amongst hyperbolic manifolds. So, by Mostert would do this, exactly. Right, so that's why you introduce this class of Einstein, because it's sort of the right... Now, hyperbolic in 3 dimensions is the same as Einstein. In higher dimensions, Einstein is really the right category. Well, it's a good one. So, okay, those are some nice examples. And then in 4 dimensions, well, there's a lot of examples that you guys know better than I. These, I don't know what the right names are, but, you know, the ADS black holes. So we saw some of them at the dialogue yesterday where, you know, on S2 cross D2 or T2 cross D2 or, well, I guess any Riemann surface cross D2. You know, so there's very explicit examples that you can write down, and I don't, you know, they're written by the usual type of ansatz, you know, V inverse dr squared plus, you know, blah, blah, blah. But they're very explicit. They have a lot of symmetry in a certain sense. And there are some analogs of these in higher dimensions. Okay. So in terms of examples, I'm trying to think if I know any other explicit ones. There are many other examples, and in some sense what I'll get to later in this talk is how do we get other examples? And there are two methods, which I'll come to a little bit later on. One is deformation theory, so what are the deformations of these things? And the second thing is gluing construction. So you'd like to take a couple of these and whack them together to construct more complicated ones. And that turns out to be possible. Okay, so part of my purpose today is to sort of set the stage for Robin Graham's talk tomorrow. And so to do so, let me just tell you a little bit about the local asymptotic theory of these things. So this is the local geometry near infinity. Okay, this was already stated yesterday. So this is part of their original work, the Fefferman and Graham paper, is the following. So the first observation is that any conformally compact metric, g equals rho minus 2 g bar, can be put in a very special form. Namely, I'd like to find a special defining function, find x. I'm going to call this a special boundary defining function. So that g looks like the following, dx squared plus h of x divided by x squared, where what I'm doing is I'm sort of introducing a color neighborhood picture of the boundary. Here's the boundary, here's the interior. Each of these x equals constant slices looks like a copy of y, and h of x I'm thinking of as a family of metrics on y. Okay? So this is really just, well, x is a, well, actually log x is a distance function. And in fact, how you find these special defining functions is the following. You just solve this equation, d of log x, g is equal to 1. This is a first order, seemingly singular partial differential equation. And if you actually write it and normalize it in terms of this metric g bar, it actually becomes a non-singular equation. It needs a boundary value. So there's a unique solution if I've specified a boundary value. And so there are many such choices of boundary distance special boundary distance functions, boundary defining functions, but given a representative H naught, which is a representative of this conformal class, which is representative of the conformal infinity here, I can choose the x so that when I write g in this form, this family of metrics value at x equals 0 is exactly this given metric H naught. Then there exists a unique x near the boundary, so that a h of x, well, h of 0 is equal to this given metric. Excuse me. Okay. Just to say a word about how you prove this, because I'll come back to this in just a moment. Suppose I choose any boundary defining function whatsoever, then I'd like to find the true one as a multiple of it. X is equal to e to the omega x tilde. This equation I now write in terms of omega, and that's the non-singular equation. Okay? And the boundary value, omega at x tilde equals 0, is exactly what gives you this. Okay, so that's true for any conformally compact metric. This had nothing to do with it being Einstein. But now the observation is that if I take this as an ansatz and I say, well, suppose that it satisfies this Ricci curvature equation, what does that tell me about? And suppose that H happens to be smooth in X or have an expansion in X. What does that tell me about what its expansion looks like? And the answer is, well, we know what its leading term is. That was how we arranged things. So the expansion of H of X takes the following form. Well, there are two cases, as we saw yesterday. So one is when n is odd. So the bulk dimension is even. Remember, n is the boundary dimension. Then h looks like h naught plus x squared h2 plus x to the fourth h4. And I stop at x to the n minus 1, h n minus 1. These are all even terms. I then have x to the n, hn. And then I continue. So it's even up to order x to the n minus 1. And then all these higher terms, you have terms of every integer order. Okay. When n is even, I'll write this up here, you have something slightly different. So h looks like h naught plus x squared h2. Now x to the n is even, so I have x to the n hn, but x to the n log x hn tilde, and in higher terms. Now I should say this is a nonlinear problem, so in fact these higher terms will in fact have higher powers of log. Okay. Now the important thing here is, well, this is a formal expansion in a certain sense. There is a regularity theorem which backs this up, which I'll talk about a little bit later. But the important point is here, the h naught is free. Namely, I'm allowed to sort of plug in any h naught I want. That was sort of the point of this lemma, at least on a local level. And then you can ask which of these other coefficients are determined by that. And the answer is that, well, up until this stage, they're all determined by h naught. But this term here, this hn term, is also formally free. So h naught and hn are free. Okay. Now, this is a phenomenon that you know very well from just Laplace's equation in the plane, and I'll remind you of that in just a moment. But I want to call this pair, h naught and hn, the Cauchy data. No, you only get powers of log. So, in fact, this is as complicated as expansion gets. And that's part of the theorem. That's part of the theorem. So once you know h naught and hn, then everything else in the series is formally determined by these and the Einstein equation. So you just sort of plug it in as a formal series, and you see that you can successfully solve for all of the things. These are asymptotic series, so they may not be convergent. I mean, there is a theorem that if h naught is analytic, then it's a convergent series. Okay, even when you have log terms. But you should think of these as, in this case, the theorem is that, in fact, you're smooth up to the boundary. Right? So the theorem here, this is really due full generality to Dylan Halliwell did this, the even-dimensional case. Anderson, in some sense, did the four-dimensional case. And the general case is, let me see, there's Lee, Skin, let me see, it was Crucial, Delay, Crucial, Delay, Lee and Skinner. So this is what's known as a polyhomogeneous expansion. So it's like a power series expansion, it's just that you have these other kind of funny terms in it. Okay, but it should be thought of as, you know, this is a constructible thing. You know, and what's very interesting is that these higher terms, well, let's say up until the nth stage, all of these things are determined only in terms of H naught from the formal series. And, well, remember, there's some sort of underlying conformal invariance or equivariance happening here. If I chose a different representative, if I replaced h naught by a smooth multiple of it, positive smooth multiple, you know, I'd have the same background metric, you know, in the interior. X would change. So the series sort of gets scrambled up, but somehow these individual terms are, you know, they have some sort of nice conformal property. So, for example, h2 is, I guess, the only thing it could be, which is the so-called Skouten tensor of the metric h naught. Okay, so this is the formal theory, which is, I say, due to Fairfermat and Graham, and the fact that these are true asymptotic expansions is due to these various guys. Now, what's important here, and why these are difficult theorems, is that this is a choice of gauge. This is what I'll call the Fermi gauge, if you like. It's a normal coordinate gauge. But it's not an elliptic gauge for the problem. So the Einstein equations, as you all know, are not an elliptic set of equations. So if you want a regularity theorem, you expect to sort of need ellipticity, but the operator h of x, I mean, excuse me, the function or the family of functions h of x or these family of tensors does not satisfy an elliptic equation. Okay? So by sort of singling out this one direction, you've chosen a certain type of gauge, but the problem is not elliptic on h of x. Okay? And so the difficulty is that you want to choose some sort of more global gauge, so something like harmonic coordinates or something like that, which makes h of x satisfy an elliptic equation. But the minute you've done that, then you've sort of screwed up this particular form of the equation. So you're trying to balance those two things. It's a bit of work. Okay. Okay. Any questions?
Is that form of the metric means there's no
That's exactly the import of this. There's no sort of dx, dy terms for y are the boundary coordinates. That's exactly right. So these level surfaces, so you have these level surfaces, x equals constant, then you have the gradient lines for x or log x and they're orthogonal to one another. Exactly right. Yes, and that's, tune in tomorrow for Robin's talk. So, so I call this the Cauchy data for a reason, and I'll say this again, but you should think of HN, the mapping from H0 to HN as being like a Dirichlet to Neumann mapping. Okay. Now, there may be many fillings, and so HN is not necessarily uniquely determined by H0, but it sort of is, you know, I mean, up to, you know, possibly, you know, multivalued function, but locally it in some sense is, as Robin will explain, and in certain cases it is, and so that's a very interesting question, and this HN plays a global role, and it's something that you probably have seen in some other guise. Okay. Now, purely out of these Pfefferman Graham asymptotics, there's a number of very interesting theorems that have been proved. So one is the renormalized volume. So renormalization of, well, volume, and then I want to tell you about some new theorems of other types of renormalizations. Volume in curvature integrals. Okay, so for the volume, this was Henningsen. Skinderis, yes. And then Graham-Witten investigated this volume renormalization and these curvature integral renormalizations. These curvature integral renormalizations work with my student Gerald. Okay, so what's the idea of these things? So the point is that you're trying to find a volume, and obviously the volume is very infinite. So you do a renormalization procedure, and there are two possibilities. Both are viable, and they're essentially equivalent. Well, they are equivalent, but you have to watch out for a few little things. Let me just tell you what these are. So for the volume renormalization, you integrate over the set x greater than or equal to epsilon of the volume form. This is a function which blows up as epsilon goes to zero. You can see that the volume form is going to look like, well, you write the metric for reference here, dx squared plus h over x squared. The volume form looks like x to the minus n minus 1 times something smooth or polyhomogeneous. So this has an expansion which looks like a0 over epsilon to the n plus a1 over epsilon to the n minus 2 plus blah, 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 blah. And you just throw away the singular terms. So you throw away singular terms and take limit as epsilon goes to zero. So this is the Ademard regularization. In other words, you take this complete expansion and you just take the epsilon to the zero coefficient. Okay. So that's one definition. The other definition is related to what's called Riesz regularization, which is that I take the integral over the whole manifold of x to the z dvg. This is over the entire manifold, where the real part of z is huge. Okay. This is holomorphic, and because of all of this, it admits a meromorphic extension. Okay. And I take the residue at z equals 0. I remove the residue and I take the value, you know, the finite part at z equals 0. So I take the finite part. There is a pole indeed at z equals 0. You have to remove it. Okay, well, fine. These are just definitions, but the interesting thing is, what do they mean? You know, are they well defined? And remember, the important thing is that we've used this boundary defining function here, so implicitly, these depend on this choice H0 in the conformal infinity of G. Okay, so I have my initial Poincaré-Einstein metric. It has a conformal infinity, some conformal class of the boundary, and I've chosen any representative there. It's determined for me a defining function, and then I can form either of these numbers.
Right. This is all assuming that you have a solution of the
end. Yes. In fact, this theory, and what I've called it sort of the formal theory, is it only depends on the Pfefferman-Graham expansion. No, it turns out it doesn't, because HN is trace-free.
You don't have to solve it.
No, you don't have to solve it.
They are global invariants.
These are global invariants, absolutely. But the point is that if I have any manifold with these types of asymptotics, so I, you know, these the HNs are, in fact, trace-free and divergence-free, it turns out, which makes it not dependent. But these depend on the whole bulk manifold. The X function has to be defined in the whole manifold. But again, you know, for the finite part, it's very easy to see that what's happening in any compact set, it doesn't matter. So as I say, the issue is you want to say that this is well defined. Okay, that it does not depend on this H naught here. Okay? And so the crucial theorem is that when n is odd, these are well defined. When I say these, I mean either one of these definitions, and in fact, and equal. Okay, when n is even, that they're not well defined, but they define a conformal anomaly. So that there's a very well defined local expression that tells you the different values. So I'm going to call these the renormalized volume. And in this case, it'll depend on H naught. And if I have two different choices, this turns out to be an integral of a local expression. Okay. On the other hand, when n is even, this expansion here has a log epsilon term in here, and the log epsilon coefficient is a well-defined global invariant. And it actually just depends on the boundary conformal class and not on the interior. Excuse me? This isn't an integral over the boundary. That's exactly right. Sorry, so that's a good thing from your point of view.
Can I tie all this up into spectral invariance associated with Laplacian?
Well, in some sense, yes. So let me describe what Alvin did with these things, because that's very closely related to that. I mean, by spectral invariance, you mean...
heat kernel.
Okay, so, yes. And that's exactly what these curvature integrals are I'm referring to here. Okay, so this is the volume, and this there's strong reasons from physics for understanding this. Let me just say a word about the proof, because this is what's true more generality. So the issue about showing the dependence on H naught means, well, what happens if you choose a different H naught and hence a different X? Right? Well, if you think geometrically what's going to happen, it's kind of complicated because as you change X, you change the region that you're integrating over, and, you know, it's a bit of a mess. So the important thing is if I have this H naught and X and a different choice, H naught hat and X hat, then X hat is going to be some function, e to the omega times X. Okay? And it turns out that this e to the omega also has only even terms in its, this omega has only even terms in its expansion up to order m. Okay? And that comes from looking at the equation that it solved that I alluded to, I didn't write down. So this omega has even powers of x only up to the power x. And that's really the key point in showing that these things are well defined.
Okay? Do you really think about Supermanian and Krauss?
No, I don't.
As I understand this language, there would have a renormalized definition of the volume. So you have some local interval on the boundary, and it actually automatically cancels those divergences.
So the other term would be the counter terms.
That'd be the counter terms, yeah. It may well have the same effect, so I don't know that paper, unfortunately. But right. Point. Good. Okay. So there are many other possible approaches to this. Now, is asked, what about other spectral invariants? And this is exactly what I had my student look at as one of his parts of his thesis, which is, well, suppose that you have some other curvature integral. So suppose that you have P, which some polynomial, which depends on the metric R and its covariant derivatives up to some order. Okay. Examples of these things include the heat invariants, for example. Okay. The question is, do these make sense? So can I renormalize, and exactly what I talked about here, can I renormalize this integral? Okay. Well, the procedure would be the same with either one of these things. You know, I just either take the Ademarger Ries regularization of this thing. The question is this well defined? And the theorem is exactly the same, that it is well defined. And this is really an algebraic theorem. So, you know, what you're doing is you're taking the form of the metric and you have to compute sort of what are the parities. So these are all parity arguments. You're just trying to show that this thing has the correct type of parity up to order n, or n plus 1, or, you know, there are various things you have to mess around with. Okay? And that's exactly what's needed to show that these things are well defined. Namely, if you change the boundary representative, changes this thing stays even up to the appropriate order, and it doesn't screw up the, you know, the nth term in the expansion when you throw away the singular terms. Okay?
think you have this same kind of difference between halves and
combinations. You do.
What's the reason for that?
It's because of the log epsilon term here. So it's because you have a 1 over epsilon term in DBG in the even case, but not in the odd case.
Presumably, in some cases, there is no difference. I mean, if you take powers of the Weyl tensor.
Right. So certainly, I'm not saying that these things necessarily occur, but they can occur, and you can see what terms have to appear to make it happen. Now, a particularly interesting case of this would be is the Fofian. So suppose that you take the renormalized integral of the Fofian of the metric. Well, okay, so this is some particular curvature integral. The claim is that this always makes sense, and the natural question is, what is it? And it turns out to be, in fact, exactly the Euler characteristic of M. Now, this is related to an index theorem, which Alvin's also proved. Well, so this needs regularization to make sense of this, but it turns out that, well, it's independent of regular, this is only even dimensional, of course, because it's the Fofian. I mean, this is when the bulk dimension is even, and it turns out to always be the Euler characteristic.
In practice, when you compute these functions, for example, which one is more practical?
In what sense?
Easier to compute.
When I compute, I would say, I mean, I think this one is in some sense easier. For example, showing the invariance under these different things here turns out to be really very simple with this Riesz regularization. So I think that this is probably the method of choice. So as I said, you know, what's hard here is that you're sort of integrating over a different shape, and then you have to see what happens when you have sort of the different layers when x equals epsilon versus x hat equals epsilon and so on.
So but x might be globally defined.
X is globally defined. Yeah. It doesn't really, I mean, it really only needs to be defined in a color neighborhood, but. So let me just point out the reason for this equality here. So there's a lot of sort of index theory that goes into this, which I probably won't have time to discuss today, but let me just at least indicate the reason for this, which is the following. Suppose I integrate now in this Ademard sense, let's just integrate over x greater than or equal to epsilon this Fofian. And what I get is, I'm forgetting all my constants are equal to 1, unfortunately, because I can never remember them, but I'm going to have the Euler characteristic. It doesn't change after a certain point. And then plus a term, which is the integral over x equals epsilon of some second fundamental form term. It's the transgression term on the boundary. Okay. Now, this is an equality for every epsilon. There's no regularization happening here. Now, what happens is epsilon goes to 0. Well, this guy is staying put. This guy has some singular terms, and this guy has some singular terms. And what this equality says is that the singular terms have to cancel. So in some sense, this sort of has got to be what you're saying, that, you know, here's the stuff that in this particular case, it's just the transgression terms that cancel off the singular terms. Okay? What we were interested in is what's the epsilon to the zero term in this expansion? Okay? Well, this has to be the epsilon to the zero term here plus the epsilon to the zero term here. This you can calculate, and the epsilon to the zero coefficient is zero. Okay, so that's what gives this theorem. Okay. Sure.
My instinct is you should turn the whole thing around. And you wrote that line P of G.
Yes.
Those examples are coefficients of the heat kernel.
Yes.
I would have turned the whole thing around, talked about the Laplacian.
Well, that was.
Directly.
Mm-hmm.
Finite volume, and then see the effect of that theorem that you wrote down. The extra term is the eight invariant for the T plus. The adjoint for Euler.
No, it's the this is the local term.
Huh?
This is the local term. Because the bound it's not product type near the boundary, so it's because you have this very definite second fundamental form at the boundary.
Oh. Well, but so
mm-hmm. Yeah. Fair enough, yeah, it's the boundary term, yeah.
But it sort of smells of spectral theory in general.
Well, okay, it does indeed, and so the second part of Pierre's thesis was doing it that way. Which is so, which was indeed trying to understand asymptotics of the heat kernel, I mean, for large time. So here, in some sense, this is a very local theorem, an algebraic, as I said, that you've taken T down to zero in the heat kernel, and then you let X go to zero. Okay? But you're interested in, well, what happens when T is positive or infinite and X goes to zero? And these are sort of much more global spectral problems. And you can also understand, you know, what happens with eigenfunctions and eigenvalues, and I'll get to those in just a minute. Yeah, so indeed, this is, you know, in some sense, the part of the theory where you keep analysis out, you know, fairly extensively. Yeah.
So do you generate any new invariant? Is this the new allows you to generate only the invariants you already know that are already sitting in the P, what value do is.
Well, these things are not, if you take a general one of these polynomials, the heat invariants, I don't know what these numbers mean in general. They could well be. So.
Why do you say that those must be invariant?
It's a theorem. They're invariant, these things here. They're independent of the choice of H naught. Right.
Can I ask about this X and
X? Sure.
So X is well defined, I realize, because
yes.
It's very given by the length.
Yeah.
But when you write the matrix using X, then there can be coordinate singularity when you...
Well, in the interior, there's sort of the focal radius of the boundary, and absolutely, X will itself degenerate if you demand that the metric have this exact form. But all we really care about is that the metric have this form in a Kollar neighborhood. In this case, in fact, this is true no matter what the form of the metric is. That's exactly right. Now, I know I'm skirting around your question a little bit, and I'll try to sort of steer back to that. Now, let me continue on a little bit with some geometric. So this is the sort of local algebraic theory of the boundary. Let me talk about the global analytic and geometric problems. So here's the real problem. So given Y, N, and a conformal class on it, fill it. Find a Poincaré-Einstein filling. Namely, you want to find some n plus 1 manifold with this as boundary and a conformally compact Einstein metric with this as its conformal infinity. Okay, so that's the real problem. And in fact, the real problem is not only do it once, but how many fillings are there and, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so this is the global problem. And this you should think of as a nonlinear asymptotic boundary problem. Okay. Now, I haven't exactly set it up as an elliptic problem yet, but let me just say sort of the only couple of methods that we know for generating solutions. So I should say that this problem, we're still in a pretty bad state. We don't know rigorously that. We don't know how to solve this problem rigorously in too many cases.
And
anything greater than or equal to 3. You could, and that sort of makes the problem easier. But, not that much easier.
You didn't say Y was connected.
No, the boundary could definitely be, but if you want the boundary to be sort of an asymptotic boundary, you can have as many components as you want.
From a situation where Y is sort of the asymptotic region, spatial slice,
then you could have an inner horizon or something like that. Sure, that's another perfectly well-posed problem, and you can consider it. It's not notably easier than this.
Fine.
Absolutely. 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 But anyway, it's really the same type of analysis that goes into that problem. And I don't know much about how to do that one either in general. So there are really two techniques for finding solutions. So one, as I said, we have a list of examples and we want to deform them. And the second thing you can do is glue together examples. Glue known fillings together. So let me at least just briefly say what these things mean.
Talk about this briefly once.
Sure.
First of all, you need to have a formula that Yn has to be a boundary.
Well, so indeed, absolutely. That's a necessary condition.
The other comment that I think is important to say. You not only want two manifolds, Y1 and Y2, to be coordinate,
bound, right.
You really want to fill it in with a Einstein.
Exactly right. That's really the right way to think about it, I think.
That's a very deep issue, it seems to me.
Agree, and a hard one.
Although here we just always assume that the topology is such that there are at least...
I wanted to emphasize.
Yeah, but to emphasize it, this really is a cobordism, a geometric cobordism problem. That's a very nice interpretation. So a very good way to think about it. So in deforming known examples, so let me just say, so suppose that we have a filling. So this is Poincaré-Einstein. Formal infinity of G is C, boundary of M is Y. And I'd like to find nearby Poincaré-Einstein metrics. The Einstein equation is not elliptic, so one has to introduce some sort of global gauge. And let me just state what the way, you know, a good way to formulate this is. Okay, so I start with G, and I'd like to deform G to some new metric, G plus H. If this is Poincaré-Einstein, I want this to be Poincaré-Einstein. Okay, I want H then to solve some sort of nonlinear elliptic equation. What should that equation be? Well, this is a good way to start, Ricci of G plus H plus N of G plus H. But you need to add a gauge term because this is an elliptic. And here's a good choice of gauge term, the so-called Bianchi gauge. Delta G plus H star BG of H equals 0. Here, this is the adjoint of the divergence. And BG of H is the following term. It's the divergence of the symmetric 2 tensor H plus 1 half D of the trace G of H. Okay, so I start with a symmetric 2 tensor. Tracing it gives you a function. Take D, it gives you a one form. And here I'm taking its symmetric two tensor and mapping it to one forms via the divergence. Okay, so this is the operator, BG is actually the operator that kills the Ricci tensor, and that's exactly the contracted Bianchi identity.
Okay. Physics language, would that be a gauge fixed?
This is a gauge fixed equation. That's a gauge fixed equation. So there's a little lemma here, which you need to prove, is that if you found a solution of this rolled up equation, that it actually solves this individual piece and this gauge fixing. You know, it lies in this slice, and that's true. That's true. So even though you're on a non-compact manifold, you can still make that work. The original equation is gauge invariant, but it's not elliptic. So you need to do something to make it elliptic so you have a hope of. You change it so it's elliptic, then you've solved the wrong equation, but you want to show that solutions of this elliptic equation actually are solutions of the sort of uncoupled equation, this equals zero and this equals zero, individually. And so that's an extra lemma. Well, because there's an infinite dimensional null space, for one thing, and there's an infinite dimensional co-kernel, and you don't have any regularity at the boundary, and you know, the symbol is an elliptic. You know, any notion of ellipticity you can think of, it doesn't satisfy it. And it has to do with the diffeomorphism invariance and the Bianchi equations.
But I thought you're writing an equation in a fixed gauge.
Once you do this, you're writing it. You've chosen that it lies in a slice. So if I think about the space of all metrics, here's G, right? And inside of here, you have these huge, big orbits of the diffeomorphism group. Okay, so this operator is equivariant under that, but if this is equal to zero, then it's going to be zero along the whole slice, along the whole orbit. Okay? So you'd like to choose some sort of transversal, and that's what this extra term does. So this is equivalent to, I should say, you know, BG of H equals zero and reach of G plus H plus N times G plus H equals zero. So these two equations turn out to be equivalent to this equation.
Yeah.
I refuse to write indices, sorry. Yeah. So this is divergence plus a half D trace of H. So. No, this is called Bianchi gauge.
Oh, okay. So
yeah.
Plus, okay. D I H I J plus
yes.
D I H I okay.
Exactly. Okay. And, you know, there are many other gauge choices. A more common one is to just look at the divergence of H equals zero. That's another very common gauge choice. The reason that this is a very nice one is that the linearization of this operator is very simple. So the derivative, dN sub G at H equals zero, is equal to this operator. So it's del star del minus twice. So this is a curvature operator. It's the full curvature tensor acting as a symmetric endomorphism on symmetric two tensors. I can even write that. IJ, K, L, HJ, L. Okay. So this is an extremely nice second order elliptic self-adjoint operator. Or, okay, well, so the theorem, the deformation theorem, and I should say this is originally due in the case where you're deforming around hyperbolic, the hyperbolic metric to Graham and Lee, and this is in the, about, I think the paper came out in 91, the late 80s. And there are a number of other papers that did this in slightly more general context, but, this was the idea of doing this here. So what the upshot is the following. You have a given Poincaré-Einstein metric, and roughly speaking, what it says is that if you change this conformal class arbitrarily just a little bit, you can deform the interior metric to stay Einstein. Okay, so it says that this is a well-posed boundary problem locally. Okay. Now, there may be a finite dimensional obstruction. So this operator on L2 might have a finite dimensional null space. And that's sort of the linear theory that's sort of underlying all of this, which I'm not going to have any time to talk about. But the point is that the... this will have, this is Fredholm on L2, and this will have a finite dimensional null space at worst. On hyperbolic space, it's actually invertible on L2. Okay? You can't work on L2 because this is a nonlinear problem, but at least that gives you some sort of indication of the obstruction space.
So, this is like the symbol of the leading operator?
This is the linearization. This is
the linearization of that.
Of this thing, yes. So I'm sorry, I didn't call this MG of H. Ah. I apologize. So that's what I'm calling this nonlinear operator. But what this is saying is that in the absence of an obstruction, there's a perfectly well-posed asymptotic boundary problem. You change the boundary values a little bit, these conformal infinities, and that exactly corresponds to changing the interior metrics to stay Einstein. Okay, so it's the best of all possible worlds. And, for example, it's what's used to say that near the ball, this Dirichlet-Neumann mapping is well-defined, which Robin will talk about tomorrow. Yeah?
Is this finite but small
deformation? No, it's finite but small. No, this is the implicit function theorem that I'm using here. Okay.
What if it's not asymptotically hyperbolic, but some more general?
Then the theorem is exactly the same as long as it has this conformally compact structure. If this thing has no null space on L2, then you have a well-posed boundary problem. And if this does have a null space, then this is well-posed up to a finite dimensional error. Namely, you can't pose necessarily all conformal classes as viable deformations nearby, but there's some finite codimensional slice which are allowed.
You're only allowed a finite number of
codimensional.
Finite codimensional.
Yes. So in fact, what I'm saying is that if I take this, the moduli space of all solutions of this equation, and map it onto conformal classes here, then this is either surjective locally, or at least it hits a finite codimensional submanifold. It almost fills everything out. No, it's not unique, and this is a local uniqueness. This is a local uniqueness that says that, for a nearby conformal class, there is a nearby solution, a unique nearby solution. There may be a far solution with the same conformal class, the same conformal infinity. But amongst nearby metrics, there's a unique Einstein one with that conformal infinity.
How do you define two metrics that are nearby? What is the metric?
Well, so these are complete manifolds of bounded geometry, so it makes sense to talk about two tensors as being globally in supernorm close. So that's a perfectly well-defined notion.
So it's probably something that we'll discuss tomorrow, but here you are solving the equation near the boundary and try to extend it.
No, this is a global problem. No, this is why this is hard. No, you're solving a global problem in all of M. So when I say local, I mean local deformations, local deformations in the space of metrics.
Oh.
Yes, but these are existing globally on M. So this is really solving this problem for conformal classes near to the given one.
So the analog of ATM is pretty common.
Okay. Absolutely, and that's exactly what Robin will be talking about. Yeah. No. There are indeed. Yes. It's not so hard, and you can set up a linearization of the problem. Unless the matter fields are really. There's some bizarre setup, but it'll be something of the same general category. And yes, there'll be no surprises that I've ever seen. I have to say that one couldn't find the context. Okay, well, let me at least finish this geometric part here by just talking about one other way of producing examples. And this is a theorem I proved a couple of years ago with Franck-Picard, which is you'd like to do surgery constructions. So here's one. Let me draw this figuratively here. M1, Y1. Here's another guy. Here's Y2, M2. These are both Poincaré-Einstein manifolds. Independently, the topologies may be completely different. And you can form a new one by forming a boundary connect sum. Okay. So on the boundary level, you're just taking the connect sum of these two boundaries. Right? And the theorem is that there's some way of sort of filling that in, sort of adding a little handle there. So I'll call this, M1 boundary connect sum M2. In the category of hyperbolic manifolds, this is a very classical construction called the Masket combination theorem. But so in this category, it is, well, you solve it by analytic methods, by studying this nonlinear elliptic problem. Okay, so this is myself and Picard. Okay, so this produces a lot of new examples. So in particular, as I said, you do have a wealth of examples, just different topological types, at least in four dimensions, by these various explicit models, and then you can glue them together via these types of things. And let me just tell you at least a few corollaries. One of the things that you might do once you have this is that you can then study, for example, how the renormalized volume behaves under these types of connect sums. And you can prove theorems that say that the renormalized volume is sort of unbounded, and you can say a little bit about its global behavior. For example, suppose I take a very complicated manifold that has some sort of topology on the boundary, but then I just start gluing on arbitrarily many copies of the ball here. I can get something that geometrically is the same. Conformally, I haven't moved the boundary very much, but I can make the renormalized volume as different as I want. Okay, so there are various constructions like that. Okay, well, I've gone on for an hour, and I've told you two-thirds of the story. In some sense, the algebraic and the geometric sides of things, of what we know. Now, let me just say a few words about, other things we'd like to know. So this global filling problem is a very important one. There have been various claims about, slightly more being true, and in particular, there have been some papers claiming that in certain cases you can set up a degree theory, that there's properness conditions and so on. Unfortunately, these things haven't really held together. And so, I think in terms of what's really known, I think this is it. I think there's slightly more hope in lower dimensions. In existence theory for Einstein metrics, you have a bit more control in low dimensions and four dimensions. Higher dimensions, it seems much harder. So these questions that I know you guys are interested in, how many fillings are there? So you want to do a sum over them, like in these examples we were talking about. These seem really out of reach for us right now. They seem really, really far out of reach.
But in the situations where you have integrated, there was no case where you end up finding some singularity?
Oh, so indeed there are solutions which have interior singularities. Okay. Now there are two types of interior singularities which are easy to produce.
How does it fit with this theory that you left
with? It doesn't, because these things always produce non-singular things.
Right. Okay, so
but there are solutions which have conic singularities. This is sort of a stupid picture, but it can have some sort of conic singularity here. And it's easy to find. There are explicit examples of these due to Page and Pope, for example. And you can also produce these as limits of, more general Poincaré-Einstein manifolds. And you can also have cusp singularities. So you can have manifolds where the end sort of recedes infinitely far down. Okay, so these definitely are possible limiting behaviors and possible singular behaviors of these things. These things you know explicitly that you can arrive at as a limit of smooth things. There is a theorem, slightly arguable, but there seems to be a theorem that says that these things, this is sort of the worst that could happen in the limit. Either this or this occurs. So what it says is the following. Suppose you have a family of Poincaré-Einstein metrics whose conformal structures on the boundary are converging, or at least staying in a compact set. So the boundary values are converging, or are well controlled. What's the worst that can happen in the interior? And the theorem is that in four dimensions, these are the only two things that could happen. Okay. No known examples of this type of behavior happen, but there are known examples of this. Okay. In higher dimensions, presumably, it's much worse. And there are old theorems about just compact Einstein metrics. Suppose you have a family of compact Einstein metrics whose diameter is bounded, so they're not doing something too wild. What can happen? The answer is, in four dimensions, they can develop conical singularities. And that's the worst that can happen. Okay, so really, in terms of the global existence theory, this is it. This is as far as we know. You know, there's a lot of conjectures of what should be true, but we're pretty stuck. It's a very hard analytic problem. Okay, I think certainly this direction you're talking about, finding things with horizons, I mean, that's very closely related. I don't think it's notably easier. Now, what I didn't tell you about at all is that underlying all of this is, you know, the sponsor, which is, you know, the linear PDE, which, you know, makes this all go. So how do you know that this is a Fredholm problem? How do you know that? And there are various other interesting interior to boundary correspondences. So even for the scalar Laplacian, you know, scattering theory for the scalar Laplacian is sort of the other topic I wanted to talk about, which is a way of sort of understanding, you know, global interior things in terms of boundary measurements, asymptotic measurements. And there's a lot of sort of very interesting problems there.
What are some global conjectures?
Global conjectures.
Yeah. You kind of are seeing there are some.
Well, I'd say in terms of, okay, well, one thing which I should mention about this existence theory is that there is a guess, which I think is probably has some truth to it, which is that, you know, conformal classes which are scalar positive on the boundary, so the conformal classes are positive for the Imabe invariant, okay, they admit scalar positive representatives, are somehow more stable. So the existence theory within the class of scalar positive conformal classes should be more robust. Okay, that's conjectured but not really known. Okay, so I'd say that's an important thing to really vindicate that, especially in low dimensions, it's probably more close to being true. I mean, what the right conjecture is for the existence theory in general, I don't think there is a good one at this point. Okay. Well, I think Robin will talk about some more things. Anyway, so as I said, I've left out sort of the technical underpinnings of this, but from a geometric point of view, this is what we've been able to do. And there are a number of refinements of these issues. There's a number